This episode's audio was generated using AI technology. I mean, 2025 really gave us the best nine-month market start since, what, 1997?
Yeah, 1997. It's been an incredible run.
Right. So portfolios have been absolutely surging. And, you know, if you just glance at the surface level numbers, everyone is feeling, incredibly wealthy right now.
Oh, absolutely. Retail investors are basically euphoric.
But, and this is a massive but, if you dig into the new Natixis Global Survey, there is this huge contradiction that emerges.
Right.
Despite these record highs, 74% of institutional investors are actively bracing for a serious market correction in 2026.
It's a really striking divergence, honestly. You've got the largest capital allocators in the world aggressively pricing in uncertainty and downside risk.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, regular retail investors are largely still riding the momentum, basically assuming the current conditions will just persist indefinitely.
Which is exactly why we're here. Welcome to another episode of Compound Interest.
Glad to be here.
Today, we are pulling from a massive stack of freshly released 2026 institutional outlooks, some really dense quantitative market research, and updated tax planning guides.
The heavy reading.
Exactly, the fun stuff. The objective today is to figure out how to mathematically protect and compound your wealth when the market environment, you know, inevitably shifts beneath your feet.
Because it always does.
Right. And a quick reminder, we aren't here to give specific financial advice. Always consult a professional for your own situation. But we are going to decode the macro cycle, master the advanced math of portfolio rebalancing, and optimize the tax strategies you need to keep your money actually working for you.
And to really build long-term wealth, I mean, you first have to accurately assess the environment you are operating in.
Right.
For the last several years, the environment was, well, it was entirely dominated by a single narrative. Between 2020 and 2024, the Magnificent Seven tech stocks drove nearly 45% of the S&P 500's total returns.
45% from just seven companies. It's wild. It was this era of hyper-concentrated growth. It's like a championship sports team where one superstar is just scoring all the points.
That's a perfect way to look at it. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, the Finance Core Tech Report shows a fundamental structural change is currently underway.
The bench is finally getting subbed in.
Exactly. We are finally seeing a true broadening of the market. By the third quarter of 2025, non-tech S&P 500 earnings growth accelerated to 12% year over year.
Wow. And that's a massive jump, right? From just 3% in Q2.
A huge jump. And that rotation makes complete economic sense when you look at the Federal Reserve. The Fed is currently holding rates in the 3.50 to 3.75% range.
Which is key.
Right. Because that specific stabilization makes rate-sensitive sectors, so industrials, real estate, utilities, and small-cap stocks, highly attractive to institutional capital.
Because those are inherently capital-intensive businesses, right? Like, utilities and industrials carry heavy debt loads just to fund their physical infrastructure and manufacturing facilities.
Exactly. They run on debt.
So when financing costs drop, or even if they just stabilize at a predictable, manageable level, their profit margins expand mechanically. Like, they aren't inventing new technology.
Right. They aren't building a new AI chip.
Exactly. Their existing operations just become mathematically more profitable.
Precisely. And this rotation, you know, it's not just a domestic phenomenon. The Natixis data shows 88% of institutions are maintaining or increasing their allocations to European stocks.
Wow.
Yeah. And 90% are doing the same for the Asia Pacific region.
That's massive.
It is. Furthermore, Lazard Asset Management notes that emerging markets are entering their most promising period in over a decade. It's all being driven by improving baseline earnings and solidifying fundamentals.
Okay, let's unpack this, though. Let me push back for a second.
Sure.
If tech growth actually stalls, let's say, because hyperscalers pull back on their massive artificial intelligence capital expenditures, like say they just stop buying tens of billions of dollars worth of servers and data centers,
no.
Can utilities and industrials seriously carry the entire S&P 500? Or are we just, I don't know, shifting deck chairs on the Titanic? Like, is this institutional rotation just defensive posturing? Are they just seeking shelter before a broader crash?
Well, that is the exact anxiety driving the institutional data. Historically, a broadening market signals organic, healthy economic growth across multiple sectors.
Right.
But those institutional managers, they're still assigning a 49% probability to a 10 to 20% downturn in 2026.
So a coin flip, basically, that we see a major correction.
Exactly. They are rotating to capture yield, yes, but they are also seeking defensive safety against you know, lingering inflation stickiness, geopolitical shocks, global tariffs, all of it.
Which really means holding a passive, you know, set it and forget it portfolio is a massive liability right now.
Absolutely.
Relying on the tech concentration of the last 4 years to protect your wealth over the next 4 years is just dangerous. So we need a mathematical system to lock in these recent gains without completely sacrificing our future compounding.
And that brings us to rebalancing. Right. Now, a lot of investors view portfolio rebalancing as a mechanism to artificially boost returns. But Morningstar's recent piece clarifies this definitively.
Right. It's not about making more money.
No. Rebalancing is strictly a risk reduction tool. Hmm. If you target, say, a 60-40 allocation of stocks to bonds and a massive equity rally pushes you to 70% stocks, you haven't just made money.
Right. You've changed your whole risk profile.
Exactly. You have unknowingly increased your portfolio's volatility.
So Morningstar recommends establishing a 5 to 10 percentage point variance threshold, right?
That's right.
Meaning you don't rebalance based on a calendar date like, oh, is January 1st time to trade? You rebalance based on drift.
Yes, the mathematical drift.
Right. So once an asset class drifts beyond that boundary, say your 60% equity target hits 66%, the math dictates you sell the overweight asset and buy the underweight one.
And your age dictates how aggressively you actually apply this. If you are under 50, you are strictly in the accumulation phase. You want to maintain high equity allocations because you have the time horizon to absorb and recover from a market correction.
Makes sense.
But if you are over 50, Morningstar stresses the absolute necessity of rebalancing into high-quality fixed income to build what they call a bulwark.
Yeah, that bulwark concept is crucial. I love that word. Because if equities tank, you draw your living expenses from that safe bucket of cash and bonds.
Exactly.
It prevents you from being forced to liquidate your stocks at the absolute bottom of the market just to pay your electric bill.
Right. But we can actually take this concept of algorithmic risk management much further than just basic percentage drift.
Okay, let's get into the heavy math.
Let's do it. The quantitative research from the ARENA study on metaheuristic algorithms.
A very casual beach read.
Oh, totally. But it explores a highly structured strategy called CPPI. That stands for Constant Proportion Portfolio Insurance.
CPPI. Okay, walk us through how the actual math operates in a live portfolio, because I think this is fascinating.
It is. So it relies on three specific variables. First, you establish a floor. This is the absolute minimum dollar amount of wealth you're mathematically willing to accept.
Okay.
So if you have a $100,000 portfolio and you refuse to let your wealth drop below $70,000, your floor is exactly $70,000.
Okay. So the floor is hard-coded. It does not change.
Yes. The second variable is your cushion. The cushion is simply your total wealth minus your floor. So $100,000 minus $70,000 gives you a cushion of $30,000.
Got it.
Finally, CPPI uses a constant multiplier. Let's just call it M, which is applied directly to your cushion. If your multiplier is 2, you multiply your $30,000 cushion by 2, which equals $60,000.
Okay, tracking. So that $60,000 is the capital allocated to risky assets like equities.
Correct.
And then the remaining $40,000 of the total portfolio goes into risk-free assets like short-term government bonds.
Exactly. It dictates your allocation based entirely on your distance from your predetermined floor.
Hold on, though. Let's run that formula through a market correction, because here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay, let's test it.
If the stock market crashes, my total wealth drops, obviously. So if my wealth drops to, say, $85,000, my floor is still $70,000.
Right.
That means my cushion shrinks to $15,000. Applying that same multiplier of 2 means I can now only hold $30,000 in stocks.
Mathematically, yes.
The CPPI mechanically forces me to sell equities after they have already dropped in value. I mean, doesn't that directly violate the cardinal rule of investing? You are actively selling low.
Well, it is a purely momentum following strategy, which is the exact primary criticism leveled against it. In a drawdown, you are mechanically selling equities and buying bonds.
Right.
But you have to look at the structural guarantee here. The design mathematically ensures you cannot breach that $70,000 floor. Huh. It prioritizes absolute downside protection over value averaging.
It's like a casino strategy, right? You only bet with the house's money once you've hit your initial target to protect your buy-in.
That's a great analogy. And to understand its popularity with institutions, you have to look at how it behaves in a bull market.
Okay, so if we get a sustained rally, my total wealth might climb to $120,000. My floor remains at $70,000, so my cushion expands to $50,000.
Exactly.
Multiplied by two, I am now allocating $100,000 to equities. So as the market rises, the math systematically forces me to buy more winning assets.
Right. It aggressively captures upward momentum while maintaining an ironclad, unbreakable floor. It removes the emotional paralysis of trying to guess market tops and bottoms.
Okay, I see the appeal. But implementing either of these strategies, whether using a basic 5% variance threshold or running a full dynamic CPPI model, requires constant trading.
It does. It's active.
You are constantly selling assets to maintain the ratios. And if you are selling appreciated assets, you are triggering capital gains taxes, which creates this massive silent drag on the compounding process.
It is a severe friction point. The 2026 Wells Fargo Tax Planning Guide outlines that long-term capital gains rates, so for assets held longer than 12 months, are sitting at 0%, 15%, or 20%, depending on your adjusted gross income.
And remember, those rates stack directly on top of your other taxable income.
Yes.
Every dollar paid to the IRS is capital permanently removed from your compounding equation. It's just gone.
Exactly. The standard defense mechanism here is tax loss harvesting. The mechanics are fairly straightforward. If you are forced to sell a winner and take a gain to rebalance, you strategically sell a losing position to offset that exact tax hit.
Right. It's like returning a sweater that doesn't fit to get store credit for something better.
Good way to frame it. You net your short-term gains against short-term losses.
Yeah.
You net long-term against long-term. And then you basically net the nets.
And if you end up with excess losses, you can deduct up to $3,000 of those losses against your ordinary income, carrying the remainder forward to future tax years.
It is highly effective, but the IRS heavily regulates this tactic through the wash sale rule.
Ah, yes, the wash sale rule.
The rule prevents you from selling a security at a loss and then buying a substantially identical security within 30 days before after the sale.
Right.
If you violate that 30-day window, the loss is completely disallowed and you get absolutely no tax benefit.
This is the exact trap that catches so many active investors. Like, say you hold a struggling tech index fund. You want to harvest the loss for the tax benefit, but you still fundamentally believe in the tech sector's long-term trajectory.
Right. You don't want to be out of the market.
Exactly. You don't want to sell, wait 30 days, and risk watching the market rebound 8% while you are just sitting in cash.
Well, the Wells Fargo guide highlights a highly tactical workaround for this known as doubling up.
Okay.
If you have the available liquid capital, you buy a second identical batch of those shares before November 30th. You now hold double the position in that asset.
Okay, so I have twice as much.
Yes. You wait the mandatory 31 days to fully clear the wash sale window. Then, at the end of December, you sell the original shares that were sitting at a loss.
Oh, wow. So you maintain constant, uninterrupted market exposure the entire time, but you legally lock in the tax loss for the current calendar year.
Exactly. It requires a temporary injection of cash to hold the double position, sure, but it completely solves that 30-day exposure gap.
That is incredibly clever, but what about mutual funds?
Ah, yes. Investors also need to be hypervigilant regarding mutual fund capital gain distributions. Actively managed funds will establish a record date and an X date near the end of the year to distribute the gains they realize from internal trading.
Right. If you buy into an actively managed mutual fund right before they distribute those gains, you get hit with a tax bill for growth you didn't even participate in.
You essentially bought someone else's tax liability.
Exactly. You always have to wait until after the X date to initiate a new position. But stepping back from the minutia for a second, do the transaction costs of all this maneuvering, you know, the trading fees, the bid-ask spreads, do they actually wipe out the mathematical tax benefits?
Well, what's fascinating here is the Arena study specifically factored transaction costs into their optimization models. And they proved that frictional trading costs present a significant drag on overall returns.
So it's not a free lunch?
Not at all. Tax loss harvesting should not be an automatic reflex to every minor market dip, nor should it be a frantic, poorly planned chore in late December. It requires careful year-round calculation to ensure the hard tax savings mathematically exceed the frictional costs of the trades.
Well, Morningstar offers a much simpler structural solution to all of this. Just concentrate your rebalancing efforts inside tax-sheltered accounts whenever possible.
The best way to do it, if you can.
Right, because if you rebalance a portfolio by selling appreciated assets inside an IRA or a 401k, the trades do not trigger capital gains taxes, provided the capital remains within the shelter.
That strategy, however, relies entirely on having sufficient capital accumulated inside those sheltered accounts to begin with.
True.
Which makes fully understanding the 2026 contribution limits and tax regulations critical, especially since the landscape shifted on July 4, 2025, with the implementation of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
Yes. OBBA.
Yes, OBBA.
Examining just the raw financial mechanics of OBBA, it introduces highly specific temporary deductions for 2026 designed to lower your adjusted gross income.
Right. There are some very unique carve-outs.
Yeah. So there is a $6,000 deduction for individuals 65 and older, a $10,000 deduction for qualified car loan interest, a $25,000 deduction for qualified tip income, and a $12,500 deduction for overtime compensation.
The economic intent behind these targeted deductions is to provide immediate liquidity and tax relief to very specific labor segments.
Right.
If you qualify for the tip or overtime deductions, you can significantly suppress your taxable income for the year, freeing up cash flow that can be aggressively routed right into your retirement vehicles.
And the limits on those compounding engines are substantial for 2026. The maximum employee deferral for a standard 401k is $24,500. Individual retirement accounts, IRAs, are capped at $7,500 or $8,600 if you are 50 or older.
But the catch-up contributions for workplace plans have evolved into, well, basically a complex maze.
Yes, weird.
They require precise attention. If you are aged 50 to 59 or 64 and older, your catch-up contribution limit is $8,000.
Okay.
However, if you fall into the very specific window of ages 60 to 63, you are granted a specialized higher catch-up limit of $11,250.
So if you are exactly 60 to 63 years old, you are in this supercharged accumulation window.
Exactly.
You have to ruthlessly allocate cash flow to maximize that $11,250 limit, because the moment you turn 64, that structural advantage just disappears.
It drops right back down to $8,000.
That's so strange. Meanwhile, Davis Capital Management points out the increasing institutional emphasis on Roth 401ks and Roth IRAs. They strongly advocate for tax diversification, splitting your contributions between traditional and Roth accounts to actively hedge against future tax rate changes.
And beyond just hedging against legislative tax hikes, Roth accounts offer immense structural advantages for wealth preservation.
Yeah.
Specifically, a Roth IRA has no required minimum distributions, or RMDs, during your lifetime.
Which is a massive lever for long-term compounding. It's like choosing between paying the toll when you get on the highway versus when you get off. With a traditional account, the IRS forces you to start withdrawing capital and paying ordinary income tax on it at a specific age, regardless of whether you actually need the cash for living expenses.
Right. A traditional IRA can force you to liquidate assets at highly inopportune times. It could potentially disrupt a carefully constructed CPPI model or force a sale during a market drawdown.
Yeah, worst case scenario.
But a Roth account allows your portfolio to compound uninterrupted, entirely on your terms.
And from an estate planning perspective, it acts as a completely different asset class. If you pass a traditional IRA to your heirs, you are essentially handing them an embedded tax liability. They have to pay income tax on those distributions.
Exactly.
But passing a Roth gives them tax-free growth and tax-free withdrawals, preserving the full mathematical power of the accumulated capital.
Because tax diversification is not simply about guessing your future marginal tax bracket.
No.
It is about retaining total flexibility and control over how and when your wealth is taxed over a multi-generational timeline.
So if we look at the whole picture, the operational playbook for 2026 requires adaptability, but the math is entirely manageable. We have a macro environment broadening out into industrials and utilities as financing rates stabilize, yet institutions are heavily hedging for a potential correction.
Right.
We can utilize variance thresholds and mathematical frameworks like CPPI to establish an unbreakable floor on our wealth while remaining exposed to upside growth.
And we can deploy specific tactics like doubling up and careful mutual fund timing to mitigate the tax friction generated by that rebalancing ensuring our capital remains fully deployed.
Exactly. And we can exploit every nuance in the 2026 tax code, from the new OBBA targeted deductions to that hyper-specific 60 to 63 catch-up window to funnel maximum capital into structurally advantageous tax-free accounts.
Before we conclude, though, there is one final piece of the Natixis institutional data that really demands attention.
Oh, right.
As these massive funds brace for economic uncertainty, they are quietly abandoning the traditional 60-40 portfolio of stocks and bonds. The new institutional standard is rapidly becoming the 60-20-20 model,
which is 60% allocated to equities, 20% to fixed income, and 20% dedicated entirely to alternative assets.
Exactly. They are pouring substantial capital into private debt, private equity, and private infrastructure. They are hunting for yield and non-correlated returns that the heavily concentrated public markets can no longer guarantee.
That represents a fundamental shift in capital allocation by the largest players in the financial system. So the provocative question we want to leave you with today is this. As an everyday investor determined to build durable wealth, how are you going to adapt your strategy to gain exposure to those private alternative markets?
That's the big question.
How do you ensure your compounding engine keeps pace with institutional yields over the next decade? It is a complex landscape, but with the right math and the right framework, you can ensure that compound interest keeps working relentlessly in your favor.
Absolutely.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Compound Interest. Keep analyzing, keep optimizing, and we will see you next time.